Okay, so should I start?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hi, welcome to Sistery Untold. We are your sisters and hosts, Marva
and Sabrina.
And on this podcast, we look at history through the eyes of sisterhood.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. So today we have a special guest on the podcast, Catherine McInnes, who's the author of Snow Widows, Scott's Fatal Antarctic Expedition Through the Eyes of the Women They Left Behind. And this is Catherine's second book on the Scott Expedition. She is also the author of Woman with the Iceberg Eyes, Oriana F. Wilson, which came out in 2019. And this particular book she's talking about today, Snow Widows, is a project that was 10 years in the making. And she spoke with people who personally knew the women that she's writing about. And the story just really comes to life. So I'm super excited for you guys to hear about her talking about each of these five women's lives, their relationships with one another, and with their husbands who went on this doomed expedition. So, yeah.
Yeah, and Catherine, she was such a lovely guest. We loved talking mm-hmm. to her. We ended up talking to her for like 3 hours. So you're not going to get the whole 3 hours because there was a lot of talk about pigeons and stuff that is probably not of interest to anyone besides ourselves. But you will be getting 2 episodes out of this because there is just a lot of material to cover, as I guess you would get if you spent 10 years researching something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she knows these stories inside and out. So she's the person to talk to about this.
Yeah, it's very impressive. But so, just like a little context setting, Scott was like a explorer in the like early 1900s, and they are exploring the Antarctic, which is the South Pole, trying to find whatever's there. And these are like very dangerous trips that people would go on, and they'd be away for like years at a time with like very poor communication. Mm-hmm. So not to give any spoilers, but the whole point is, as Sabrina said, this expedition goes to the Antarctic. It ultimately is not successful in the sense of like everyone dies. So we just wanted to set the scene a little bit, mm-hmm. talking about when the men who had been missing now for about a year were first discovered. So just to set the scene, this is a quote from Catherine's book, Snow Widows, from her research of the petty officer Thomas Williamson. This is something that he wrote on finding the tent where the bodies were. It says, "I must own, I shed a few tears, and I know the others did the same. It came as a great shock to us all, although we knew full well for months past that we should meet with this sort of thing. Everyone seemed dumbfounded. We just stood there, wondering what awful secrets the tent held."
Ooh.
And
Yeah,
so basically they find this tent. It has the husbands and sons of the women that we're going to talk about. It has their bodies frozen inside, which is tragic.
It's a horrible thing. Yeah.
Yes. And then, unfortunately, though, as this is happening, the women who were left behind, they don't even know that this has happened. They don't know that their husbands and sons and stuff are dead. And so we're going to hear from Catherine about each of the women, who they were, what they were like, and what was their experience in relation to this tragic trip.
Okay, I guess without further ado, let's dive in.
Dive in.
Hi, so we're here with Catherine McInnes, who is the author of Snow Widows, Scott's Fatal Antarctic Expedition Through the Eyes of the Women They Left Behind, which is coming out for us in a week from now. By the time our listeners hear this, probably just hit the shelves. So congratulations on that amazing accomplishment. And And yeah, we're so happy to have you here to talk about these five women who were associated with this incredible expedition. And yeah, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
I have written a biography before about one of these women, but when I wrote that, I realised that there was a bigger story, because the image that this book is focused around is the picture of five men at the South Pole, and they're lined up looking very obviously cold and tired, frostbitten, and they have just been beaten to the pole by Roald Amundsen, who is the Norwegian. And it's early in 1912, and the photograph is taken with putting a very rudimentary camera on a stick. So it's sort of the first selfie. And all those five men died before they came back. So that image was developed posthumously, not only posthumously, but a year afterwards. So they found that camera in a tent under the snow almost a year later, and then they took it back to New Zealand and developed it, and then they saw those that picture. So it's an extraordinary picture, really. And so the idea of this book is the women behind those five men. So each of those men has a sort of significant woman in their lives. In three cases it was a wife, in two cases of the two bachelors it was their mother. And so this book is trying to look at this incredibly famous story, but from an entirely new perspective. And I suppose one of the questions that the women helped to answer is why they went. You know, how had they been brought up? What was the rest of their life like that meant that they were so determined to try and achieve this geological first or geographical first? You know, what was it about the endeavour that we can understand from their lives in a sort of three-dimensional way? In fact, Virginia Woolf, I was thinking about this the other day, when she invents characters, and none of these are invented, this is a non-fiction narrative, but she talks about the caves behind her characters. Before she even starts writing a story, she talks about the caves. And these women furnish those caves behind the men. So they give us an entirely different insight. But the flip side of it is that we understand more about the women when we know the men better. So in all cases, the relationships pop into three dimensions and colour, having been quite black and white and sort of classic Arthurian legend. You know, I've never bought that it's that simple, that this story is so, you know, sort of one-dimensional. But it's been told and retold from the same male perspective so many times, it's become almost a legend, hasn't it? So this makes it a real story again. You know, people with sort of faults and foibles and who make mistakes and how they correct them and how they learn from them and that sort of thing. So I hope that sort of introduces why I did it.
We love having three-dimensional stories and like showing people with like they're good, they're bad, they're ugly. So we're super excited to hear more about the Snow Widows.
Yeah, thanks for that introduction though. I feel like the story is like obviously just so incomplete, even though it's been told so many times, if you don't have like those women furnishing the caves. I love that
it's,
metaphor.
It's her that's word. So, that's a so that's great. A Virginia Woolf description, isn't it? And I think the thing that is amazing about this is that I sent in a proposal to the History Press a decade ago, and they rejected it and said we're not interested in the story of the women behind this. And then I also sent it to HarperCollins, who are the people who have published it now, and they said no, we don't really do Wives of. So this has changed in the last decade. Isn't it incredible? And now people say that the sort of women behind the men has become a popular genre. And, you know, I was so convinced that this was an amazing story that I just kept researching it anyway, which you wouldn't do if you were a sensible person, you know, with two quite, you know, serious rejections. So, but anyway, I just did because it is amazing. It's a gripping story in it. You know, there we go. I think it's an amazing story. You know, I hope I've told it without getting in the way of it, because the story itself is an amazing, amazing narrative.
And clearly publishers finally agree. They've seen the light, so that's good. Yeah.
You're just ahead of your time.
I don't think so, but it's quite interesting, isn't it, how quickly we forget that these things have only recently become a popular genre. Yeah. And because I have those two rejection letters, and because I'm... not very good at technology, so I never believe it's going to save on a screen. So I always print these things out, so I have the printouts.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a great introduction to like how you came to this topic and everything. Yeah. Would you like to just give us kind of the foundational story of, I guess, primarily the men, but of the expedition, of like this period of exploration, and yeah, just kind of like build that world out for us?
I suppose that it is connected with the British Empire. At the time, it was, you know, the sun never set on the British Empire. It was so extensive. Mm-hmm. And so there was the Royal Geographical Society in London is the sort of mastermind, I suppose, behind this. And the interesting thing is that they had members who were fellows, so it was an exclusively male society. But there were women like Isabella Bird and Mary Wollstonecraft and people who had done some exploration, and they applied to be members, and they were rejected by this sort of bastion of male, I don't know, geographers, partly because of their education, because they didn't have formal education as, you know, the men were educated in an entirely different way. But some women were invited to be members, and then so there was a sort of split in the society, and they said, how can a woman be a fellow? Of course they can't. How ridiculous. You know, that's a contradiction in terms. We can't have them. And so this story occurs at the same time as the first women were elected to be fellows of the Royal Geographic Society. And the amazing thing is that in the first election of the major kind of membership for women happened as this tragic news was coming back in 1913, and so it was postponed. You know, it literally happened at the same time.
Really?
So this recognition of women and the demise of the British Empire was happening at the same time, and to have those two things happening at the same time is quite extraordinary. I mean, literally the same evening they postponed it because they got the news that these five men had died. And they felt that it would be inappropriate. So that's the foundational story, that it was the sort of rise of feminism at the same time as the last parts of the blanks on the globe being discovered, and the demise of the British Empire and the eve of the First World War, pretty much. Because it came...
Yeah,
that, what an extraordinary time. It really is. It's amazing. And I hope I've managed to kind of capture those cross currents, because it was an extraordinary time, I think. I don't think they knew what the First World War would be like at all. And one of the quotes, actually, that I haven't managed to get in the book, so I'll tell you, is that when the men... when the tragic news came back, one of the German polar explorers wrote to the Royal Geographic Society and said, we don't consider that the men failed. You know, they have shown themselves to be incredibly honourable and, you know, interested in the science rather than it being a race to the pole. And all these things are good. And, you know, we have an amazing respect for British people as a result of this. We'll be the first people to back them in any... you know, with any problem, and less than a year later they were at war. It's quite interesting to see that it was really the Kaiser and the leaders that were in conflict. The men weren't at all. The British thought that the Germans were great, and the other way around. It was entirely another person's sort of agenda. I never managed to get that quote in, annoyingly, but anyway, there we go.
Were these expeditions, though, like only like on a ship, like only British people, only German people, or did they ever like go on expeditions together?
Well, in Scott's expedition on the Terra Nova, which is 1910 to 1913, there was one Norwegian, funnily enough, because they didn't know that Amundsen was going to go and compete with them for the South Pole at the time. Because he said he was going to the North Pole, and then he sailed to Madeira and called a meeting with all his men and said, actually, we think that Robert Peary, an American, has got to the North Pole first, so now we're going to the South Pole. If anyone wants to leave, please leave. And there was a stunned silence on his boat as they realised. And nobody did leave. So there's one Norwegian who's Scott employed as a ski instructor, and he came with the British expedition to the Antarctic because he didn't know at the time that his country was going to be competing with Britain. So it's a strange situation. But the extraordinary thing is that when they left the hut to be able to go to the South Pole, of when they started making that sort of final journey on the sledges, they forgot the Union Jack back at base. And the only person who could get it was the Norwegian ski master. So the Norwegian brought the British flag to Scott to be able to take to the South Pole. Isn't
that extraordinary? That's so interesting.
Anyway, back to the women. Yeah. So these women, there are five of them, I think represent the British kind of society of the time. So one of them, Kathleen Scott, was quite unconventional. She was an artist. One of them had a very scientific mind, but she was really an assistant to her husband, and a very able assistant. After his death, she suddenly became recognised as a scientist in her own right, and she got a CBE from the New Zealand government for her help with the New Zealand soldiers during the war. So it's quite interesting to see the effect on these women after their men died. Mm-hmm. They suddenly became higher profile, and you know, it's interesting to change. And so also when you look at the class system in England at that time, at the beginning of the 20th century, it was very very clearly defined, and it was very difficult to move between different classes. And so of these five men, that image, to take you back to it, that image at the South Pole of those five men that never made it home, one of the men was a petty officer, which is the ratings class. So he was a working class chap. His wife worked for a living. You know, she worked in a pub, and she worked gathering cockles on the shore on the beach. And so she represents that class who really didn't have much of a voice. So she is a very interesting insight into the working class at that time. And then one of the other people, perhaps one of the most famous men, who is Captain Oates. He's the one who, his quote is that he left the tent and said, "I may be some time," and he walked out to his death because he didn't want the others to be held up by him because his feet were frostbitten. Yes, I don't know if you knew that one. Yes. Oh, wow. So he walked out, and he wasn't married, but his mother was the sort of lady of the manor of Gestingthorpe. So she was in charge of a whole village and a massive estate in Essex. So with those five men at the South Pole, they're all in an equal position. They all have the same kit. They have the same distances. They have exactly the same food, you know, portioned very, very carefully into rations. But actually, that's quite a fascinating thing because they came from totally different classes, and their life experiences elsewhere than the Antarctic was entirely different. And the final lady is quite representative of this time because she was a missionary teacher in Penang, in Malaysia, which was then called Further India. So she trained at the Cheltenham Teachers Training College. She was very, very bright and very Christian. And so she went out and taught in Penang, and she met her husband there. And so she is also, you know, quite representative of this era. So they're five very different women. So even if they weren't the women behind these five men at the South Pole, they would be a wonderful cross-section to be able to tell the history of the time.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that they're all in such different, like, geographical regions, like Malaysia, New Zealand, around the UK. Was that, like, that type of, like, mobility, like, pretty common in the early 20th century, especially for women, to, like, move away from your home country?
Well, I think, yes, I think it was. I think that people went to make their fortune in the sort of furthest reaches of empire. And so a lot of people did go abroad. And so I think it was quite common for people to have relatives in the New World. So either New Zealand and Australia, which were being colonized at the time, or the Americas, but also the whole kind of Indian thing was well, Captain Oates, the maybe sometime chap, was a cavalry officer, and his regiment was posted in, I don't even know how you pronounce it. This is the weird thing about lockdown. I've never had to say these words. I only have to yeah. spell them, but it sounds like Madao. Yeah. Anyway, and his regiment was posted there. So, and Birdie Bowers, Emily's son, so the son of the missionary teacher, worked for the Royal Indian Marine. So he was permanently kind of around India in his boat. So yes, all these people worked abroad, had at some point worked abroad. So I think that
I guess like with better, I mean, because I study like a much earlier period, so like it takes like months to get anywhere, but I guess like ships and like trains had like gotten a lot better by this point, so it was like reasonable to like travel outside of the UK, I guess.
But I do think it did take them a long time to get anywhere, and funnily enough, this is what I love about sort of this type of history. Kathleen Scott, to get anywhere you had to go on a boat, and Kathleen Scott was chronically seasick. She could never get over it. So she was incredibly strong and quite forthright woman, but you go onto a boat and you get seasick and you become totally kind of mouse-like. You can't speak to anyone. And there were these bottles of Mothersill. So she used to just pop all these sort of seasickness pills, which had belladonna in them. But on the label of the Mothersill pill packet that I've seen, because it's fun to sort of get down to the detail with this stuff, it says, you know, this is how Britain rules the waves. And it's true. How on earth could everybody go across to the Empire if they were just so chronically seasick that they had to pull up the sails or work the steamship, or, you know, so amazing.
Wow.
And that's a very clever like little catchphrase.
Yeah. And it just shows how like the like nationalism is like on every like huge scale and also like a tiny scale, like the top of a bottle. Yes. Like it's like the patriotism and like the nationalism.
That's a lovely way of looking at it. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's the bit of history that I find really interesting, looking at the detail of it, because then you feel more in touch with it, don't you? We don't live our lives in great big broad brushes. The way we experience our lives is in texture and taste and smell, that is, you know, all makes things come alive. So I try and and work as much detail as I can into the story. It was also the time that aeroplanes were absolutely in their infancy. So Charles Rolls of Rolls-Royce, so the Rolls-Royce car man, he was flying a Wright Flyer. So that's the Wright brothers who invented flying. So he had a Wright Flyer, and he wanted to be able to fly across the channel and back, the first man ever to do it. So he did it, you know, put on his tweed cap, canvas wings, you know, wooden frame for the thing, and he flew to Sangatte and back. And
and this is like 1910.
I think maybe he did that in 1909 or 10. Yes, but it's extraordinary, isn't it?
You could not pay me to get into a wooden plane.
But people do paragliding, don't they? And they go in microlights, so they're still. I mean, that's got the engine of a mower, so they're still. But they're more reliable, aren't they, than the Wright Flyer? Anyway, but this is rather a sad story, because he actually died at an air show, because the tail of his Wright Flyer broke off. And then his mother commissioned Kathleen Scott, so Scott's wife, to make a statue of him. He was called Charles Rolls. She had to go along to Charles Rolls's house, and Charles Rolls's mother gave her his clothes, and you know, the cap was bloody because he'd died from a head injury. Anyway, she came back and she was an amazing sculptress. She had studied under Rodin in Paris. And so recruited a footman who was the same height as Charles Rolls. So I think he was about 6 foot 4 or 5, enormously tall, particularly for that time.
Really tall.
And so she had him in her studio, and she was, you know, kind of making this big, big sculpture that was going to be put in as a bronze statue in Portsmouth. And so because she had a baby, she had baby Peter, she tried to do these things sometimes in the evening. So there she was, letting a single man out of her house at 11:30 at night with her husband away at the pole. And she was, you know, it was quite tricky. She did develop a bit of a reputation. But anyway, so she made that sculpture, but when it was in unveiled, that was when Scott was away, Charles Rolls's mother sobbed. And at the time, they had Pathé film cameras recording all this stuff. You know, black and white, flickery, no sound, but it was recording it. Mm-hmm. And she, in her diary, writes, you know, why couldn't she stop crying? Does she want that to be the record that is, you know, I was building her son into a hero, and she's kind of, you know, crumbling. Mm-hmm. And she's quite tough, Kathleen Scott. Mm-hmm. And she says, if that was my son, I hope I wouldn't sob like that. I know, pretty tough woman.
Oh, dang.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And how did she deal with her husband dying? Was she kind of like very strong about it, or was she emotional?
She was, this is an amazing thing, because we're talking about the ships and the fact that she was seasick. So she actually was sailing from California, so across the Dateline to New Zealand, because she decided to go that way out to New Zealand rather than the normal route, which was around South Africa and then Australia and New Zealand. She decided to go kind of the other way around the world. And so when the news came back to Britain, she was at sea. And at the time, Marconi hadn't invented a radio signal which could reach her ship. So the rest of the world knew that her husband was dead, but she was in a ship going out to meet him, and nobody could contact her. So the news was traveling in cables, undersea cables. And so actually her ship was sailing over the cable line where the news was going. So it was, she was so near it, but she had no idea. So she was just enjoying, a kind of, you know, sailing out, and she just knew she was going to reach an island. I think she went to Tahiti, and she was kind of, you know, said it's lovely and hot and, you know, beautiful colours and all that sort of thing. But it is the most amazing thing. Let me just see if I can, is it possible to read you the moment that she found out? Is that okay to read an excerpt?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is the 19th of February, 1913. She's between Tahiti and Rarotonga in the Pacific. Kathleen sits on the recently swabbed deck, which is beginning to steam in the heat. Focusing her eyes on the horizon and breathing deeply, she is concentrating on keeping her breakfast down. Out of the corner of her eye, she notices that the captain has left the bridge and is walking up the wooden deck towards her. Turning, she notices that his hands seem to be trembling. He tells her that he wants to speak to her in his cabin. Kathleen is better in the open with the sea air blowing on her face. She has no idea why she's been summoned in this way and has no desire to leave the fresh air of the deck. But I went. That's in quotes. Once in the cabin, she tries to get the interview over with as fast as possible. I've got some news for you, he says, but I don't see how I can tell you. The expedition, says Kathleen. Yes. Well, Kathleen says, let's have it. And he shows her the message. And the message reads, Captain Scott and the others perished in a blizzard after reaching the South Pole on January the 18th, 1912. I remember, Kathleen wrote in her diary later, I said without the least truth, oh well, never mind, I expected that. Thanks very much, I will go and think about it.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't it incredible? Anyway, listen, and she asks the captain to discuss the news with no one but the officers who already know. That hot tropical air is oppressive, and yet she cannot be on the crowded deck. It is the hour at which she sometimes has Spanish lesson. She goes to her lesson for an hour and a half and acquits herself well. She walks to the dining room for lunch. She sits with the groups and discusses American politics. After lunch, she is still not sure she can control herself. She begins to write her diary, her writing small and upright rather than her customary loose, leaning hand. Halfway through, the writing deteriorates as if she has swapped her left hand or begun dictating to a child who has just learned to hold a pen. She makes herself read her book on the sinking of the Titanic. She has been commissioned to sculpt a memorial of the Titanic Captain Smith on her return, the man who went down with his ship. So her first reaction is, you know, isn't that extraordinary?
Wow. I have chills. That's
but
like
then
such
eventually
a...
it catches
oh my
up
gosh.
With her. You know,
yeah.
There she is, totally exposed because she's in a goldfish bowl. Yeah. Everybody knows who she is, yeah. and they're all looking for her reaction.
Yeah.
And they mm-hmm. don't know the news either because they're all on the boat and none of them yeah. can get it. So
yeah.
then she carries on sailing yeah. until she reaches an island. Wow. And then the news is up in the post office there because the cables can get to that island. So then everybody else on the ship knows too.
Mm.
So she's still not in New Zealand. So she has to go all the way to New Zealand with all
mm-hmm.
these people buzzing with the news.
Mm.
So it's the most extraordinary
mm.
thing. And the thing that she
wow.
was most upset about was thinking of the responsibility, because he was the head of that expedition. She felt he would have died thinking, you know, the deaths of these men are on my hands. And she really said, you know, always his pain
Aww.
Boring into my brain. That's a quote.
Mm.
And one of the people on the boat, I think it was a lieutenant, was tasked to look after her because they all thought that she would just jump overboard and kill herself.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And actually, mm-hmm. she realised this was happening, and she wrote in her diary, actually, I don't believe in God. Otherwise, so I know I can't reach him by killing myself. And also,
oh my
she gosh. They had this 3-year-old child at home, so she wanted to get back
mm-hmm.
for him.
Yeah.
So it was the most extraordinary situation that there had been an enormous funeral. Thousands of people had gone to this memorial service in St. Paul's
mm-hmm.
in London,
mm-hmm.
And she wasn't there because she didn't know
yeah.
about it.
Oh my gosh.
And so she didn't know until she, you know. Then she landed in New Zealand, and then she was told. So that, you know, I mean, she was told, and she was given Scott's diary, and she was given. So
mm.
then it became real. But I think it was it's the most extraordinary story. All these cables
mm-hmm.
and, you know,
mm-hmm.
rushing around the world, and she is in the middle of it, not knowing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so tragic.
Mm. Yeah, so tragic. And her reaction, like, just being so cold and normal, but then her handwriting, kind of like. Telling the truth that she's like kind of falling apart, like that's just so crazy. Yeah,
isn't that
she was like holding
see,
so much in.
Yeah, but also
yeah.
I love this about biography, these archive items that you get, because
mm-hmm.
for me the fact that her writing went strange tells me more than she could ever put into words
yeah.
and write down.
Mm-hmm.
That shows
yeah.
you
yeah.
really how she was feeling, and you wouldn't
mm-hmm.
know that if you just read it as a secondary document and it was all in text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
one of the things with biography that I find, you know, these, if you were speaking in sort of Harry Potter speak, you know, I have 3 small children that grew up with Harry Potter. I think these archival documents are like portkeys, you know, they take
mm.
you instantly
mm.
into this other
mm.
world, and
mm.
you sort of
mm.
drop through 110 years and into this
mm.
place where that document was first created, and
mm-hmm.
this sort of sensation around it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's like a really cool way to think of it, like you're like time traveling and you can almost kind of picture it in your
mm.
head, and like makes it the emotion feel all that more real.
Well
mm-hmm.
also I've tried to do that by making that as you heard, it's in the present tense, and
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
so I'm trying to tell the story from each of the 5 women's perspectives, so it's through their eyes. And the reason I did it in the present tense is because I went to meet Kathleen Scott's second son, called Wayland Kennett. And he
mm.
was in his mid...
Wait, you went to meet
I
him?
I did. So the second son.
Wow.
He's
she,
alive.
No, not now. Because I've done this for a decade of...
For 10
decade
years.
Of rejections.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Decade of
yeah.
rejections, which was actually quite useful to start it sort of too early. Because most of the people
uh-huh.
I interviewed that actually knew these women are now no longer here. Only
yeah.
one of them is still alive.
Yeah.
And that it
wow.
gives you an amazing insight into what they were like. Anyway, in this case,
mm-hmm.
I met him, and we're talking a lot about Kathleen Scott, aren't we? So I must remember to talk about the others. But she lived in J.M. Barrie's old house in London. So J.M. Barrie was a friend of both Scott and Kathleen, and Peter, their son, is called after Peter Pan, because he wrote Peter Pan, J.M. Barrie.
Oh.
Oh.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Yeah. So I went to J.M. Barrie's house, and Wayland Kennett, so that's her second son, who she had with her second husband, took me up to the
mm.
nursery where
mm-hmm.
Peter Pan is supposed to have flown out of the window. You know, it's where Jay and Barry made that story up. It's quite amazing.
That's so
anyway, he had that kind of elderly mind. You know, he was absolutely charming, but he definitely had the sort of beginnings of dementia. So I said to him, you know, could you tell me a bit about your mother? I can't remember what question I asked. But then he suddenly said, well, she's over there in the corner and the lamp is here. And at that stage, there wasn't a lamp there, and there wasn't the carpet that he then described, and there wasn't the sculpture table that she was doing sculpture on. But he was honestly seeing it as if it was a film reel in his mind. And I just it was so spine-tingling. I thought, gosh, if I can tell the story like this, I would really make, you know, get people back into that place 110 years ago where, you know, it's an entirely different value system, not one that we would ever have now, thank goodness, but it's an entirely different context. You know, the whole fabric of society was different, but because he could talk like this, it sort of dropped you back into this time zone. So and the part of the problem with this story is everybody knows that Scott and his companions died at the South Pole, so what's the point of telling the story again? We all know the ending, you know. Who on earth would try and tell a story with this ending that we all know? It's mad. So in order to be able to suspend your belief and try and make you feel as if it could end differently, if I tell it in the present tense, then you're living it with them rather than being wise in retrospect. So that it, nobody's done this before with biography, which is why it is rather scary. But of the three reviewers that I've had so far, two of them are polar historians, and they've both said, one of them said, it's you know, I can't remember quite what she said, but something like it's almost a supernatural recreation of the past. And the other person said, you know, it really isn't fiction. It is completely accurate historical narrative, but it just is telling the story in a different way. I hope that you would agree with that if you read it.
I love the writing style, definitely. It definitely like drops you into the moment, and like just the way it starts with talking about like the like symphony, like orchestra scene, like just like expands it beyond what I like expected it to be about, and like all the like different names of different people like who like made up this like section of society makes it feel like really like full and complete, which I think is like,
well, that's
really
great.
Cool.
I'm glad you felt that. It is just, you know, it's kind of a crazy idea to try and tell it even from five perspectives, but you have to give the male response, so that's 10 perspectives. And I was just thinking, I must be mad. So but an orchestra manages to make one sound, doesn't it? So that was the idea. Borrowing from music. And the fact of using that particular concerto is that the same man sponsored Elgar and Scott. So this chap called Sir Edgar Speyer was a very rich German banker, and he sponsored the Queen's Hall and the proms, and particularly composers like Edward Elgar and Strauss and Debussy and people like that. But he also was the main sponsor for Scott. There's a mountain in the Antarctic called Mount Speyer from Scott's first expedition. And for this expedition that I'm talking about, the Terra Nova, he was the treasurer and the major donor. So he was hugely involved in both their lives. But I tell you the really annoying thing, this is the thing about biography, because I'm sure you will write one. I hope you do.
Maybe one day, hopefully.
you certainly will. You certainly will. But the thing is that there's no evidence that Edward Elgar and Captain Robert Falcon Scott ever met. And so I can't make it up, because this is not it's not fiction. I mean, they must have met. They simply must have met. They had the same patron. You know, he was always having enormous parties. They must have met. But, you know, sometimes you meet somebody and you don't write it down. And if you don't have a mobile phone, you don't take a picture of yourself with them.
You know?
And so there is no evidence for that. And these are the very interesting parts of trying to write biography, particularly of invisible women like this. And we should talk about the research afterwards. I mean, the artifacts that you go from. But there's another gap, which is that Emily Bowers, who is the lovely missionary teacher and very maternal, there is no evidence for her communicating after the tragedy with Lois Evans, who is the working class lady. And I am utterly convinced that she did, but I can't find the letters. And so I can't say that she did. And I worry that that gives a completely different complexion on Emily's character. Was she, you know, without compassion? Was she, you know, of course she wasn't, because I know from the character that I've researched, but I can't make it up. So it's quite interesting, isn't it? That you don't always, these, you know, some of these things aren't preserved. I'm only working from the evidence I can see.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have information on Emily communicating with any of the other women?
Yes, a lot. She and Caroline Oates became good friends. So that's really interesting, particularly in that situation, because Caroline Oates became very bitter about the situation. She felt that Captain Scott had overworked his men, and eventually, this is a rather a scary quote to have included for the first time, but in 1934, she went to look around the Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge with Frank Debenham, who had been on the expedition and survived. He hadn't gone to the South Pole because he'd played football on the snow and he'd bust his knee. So he couldn't go. So he came back and he became the director of the Scott Polar Research Institute, and he invited Caroline to come round and look at it. And as she left, she looked back at the building and she saw Kathleen Scott's sculpture of Scott. And she pointed to it and she said to Debenham, "That man killed my son."
Ooh. Oh my gosh.
And nobody's used that quote before. But this wonderful lady called Sue Lim, who would be very fascinating to talk about, but she said Frank Debenham said it to her. And Sue Lim is the Oates biographer. She's the person that has the keys to all that information. And I said to her, "Are you sure you don't mind me quoting it? Because you didn't use it in your biography of Captain Oates." And she said, "No, I think that, you know, now's the time. I think you should." So that's quite amazing. But Emily Bowers didn't regret her son going to the Antarctic. He was 28 when he died, but she was a very, very committed Christian, and she believed that God had a plan for everyone, and that was his plan for Birdie. And she said, you know, "He really enjoyed being with you all, to the survivors, so I can't regret him going." So Caroline Oates and Emily show two different ways at the end of their lives of how they looked back on the story. Caroline Oates blamed Scott and became very embittered and very private, and even when she died she said, "I don't want anyone to know about my death. Nobody should follow the coffin. I don't want anybody at my funeral." She became you know, kind of paranoid about any publicity. And Emily was sort of generous and open right to the end, and kind of adopted all the survivors and said, "You know, you don't mind if I call you Cherry Doer," which was the man's nickname of this mute, you know, friend of her son's, "but you seem to be a little piece of birdie left to me." You know, so she was very sort of sweet. So that relationship's quite interesting because it works the contrast of how the women might react, you know, in the long run.
Yeah. And for Caroline and Emily, can you share a little bit more of, like, what happened, like, in their lives? Like, did they ever have other children, or...?
Yes, they were mothers at the time. So, interestingly, both of them were widowed well before this story began. So, Captain Oates is Caroline Oates' son, and Birdie is Emily Bowers' son. So, the story of Caroline Oates is quite interesting. She married her cousin. Her side of the family were industrialists and his side were landowners, and so she married into the sort of aristocracy, and so she was very keen about keeping up appearances, and she was always trying to get her son to wear a starched white collar so that the people, the villagers of Gestingthorpe, would respect him as Lord of the Manor. And he was a kind of real slouch and liked wearing, you know, really kind of shambolic clothes, and everybody mistook him for a farmer. And he thought this was hilarious, but she really didn't, because she was sort of very worried about being able to be a legitimate kind of aristocrat, having grown up, you know, as the daughter of an engineer. Anyway, so she married her cousin, this chap, William Oates, and then he died of TB when they went to Madeira. And so she brought up the family by herself. And she is a very interesting lady because she was anti-suffrage, but she was in charge of hundreds of people that lived in Gestingthorpe Village. She had the accounts book, she employed people, you know, she managed lots of men, and yet she was anti-suffrage. Isn't it incredible?
Yeah.
Do you think that was like a class thing, or what would be the reason
I think that the Royal Geographic Society, for example, regarded suffragettes as bounders. That was their word. They were sort of, you know, scoundrels for betraying their demure, passive class by, you know, kind of trying to get the vote. So I think that that's sort of, you know, where Caroline Oates was coming from. But I think a lot of Victorian women of this class and age were probably anti-suffrage. But I know that she was, because the insight into Caroline Oates is her accounts book. So she pays the anti-suffrage society a stipend. Okay. So that's how
she's
very against it. So that's just, isn't it extraordinary that this woman, you know, had such an important managerial role, as we would deem it now, and yet she didn't think she deserved the vote. Quite a contradiction in terms. And only... you know, I'm just putting it out there. I don't sort of analyse it. I just show you that she was a, you know, paid up anti-suffragette, and that she was in control of a lot of money, three sets of servants, because her son kept servants in India in his cavalry regiment. Oh, wow. She had a set of servants in her house in London and a set in Essex. And she had the whole of the village of Gestingthorpe. So she was in control of the school, you know, the livelihood of all these men. And yet, so it's just... She didn't see that as a contradiction. Isn't that an insight into that time?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like she also, like, she had it made. She didn't need, like, you know, suffering.
Yeah, maybe,
to some extent, because she's, like, she's living her best life.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the other anti-suffragette was Kathleen Scott. And she, you know, was quite aware of the fact that a woman born into her class, you know, she could go in, if she wanted to change something, she could just go and speak to, you know, Herbert Asquith, the Prime Minister. She could just walk into Parliament and say, I don't agree with that, you know.
Yeah.
So she didn't feel she knew the vote, needed the vote, because she knew the main influences at the time.
Yeah, they're so privileged. Yeah, it's just they're unfortunate. Like above it.
It's unfortunate that they can't see why other people might need it. And like...
Yeah.
Precisely, but...
Balance that out.
But the other extraordinary thing is that well, taking Kathleen Scott again, she went out to New Zealand to see her husband off. So she left England, where they didn't have the vote, got to Australia, where they did have the vote, and then went to New Zealand, where they did have the vote. And yet she was anti-suffrage when she could see that it worked. Yeah. So, you know, discuss. I mean, I the way that I've tried to approach this is that I just... show you the world through their eyes. I don't analyze it. I just give you the contradictions, and then, you know, you can make sense of it as the narrative unfolds and see how, you know. So it's hopefully it'll be quite interesting mentally to read it, because you get all these strange facts and accumulates into a narrative.
Yeah And I feel like to us now that seems like such an obvious contradiction, but I guess back then, like, because I've read other, I was reading a biography about Colette, the like French writer from the 19th century the other day, and she also was like super successful, like very like liberal, but like super anti-suffrage. And it just like, I guess a lot of these like educated or like wealthy women just like didn't see the need and saw them as like scoundrels kind of. So like if we were living in that period, it might seem totally logical that they were against suffrage. But from our perspective now, it seems like those things go hand in hand, like being independent and having suffrage. But
And also like the being anti-suffrage was like the mainstream. So it'd be like,
yeah, that's true.
That a thing that's out of the ordinary is being for suffrage.
Yeah.
I
and being kind of radical.
Sort of revolutionary, isn't it? And so you're upsetting the old order, you know. And if it didn't work for you, why would you?
Yeah
Exactly.
No, it is, it's very interesting, isn't it? I find it very interesting that these women were really powerful, but they refused to recognize it, you know. insisted that they were just a sort of, they should stay in the wings. And interestingly, you know, some of them, I would say, are self-erasing. So Orianna Wilson burned all her letters to her husband. So it's really difficult. I can see what she wrote to him by the way he reacts to it.
Okay, yeah.
And that's a kind of madness, isn't it?
So yeah, you have to like read between the lines all the time.
The time. Why would he be saying that? Why would he be reacting like that? Mm-hmm. So in one situation, for example, I found a picture of Orianna while her husband was away with Scott. She is lying in a, I think they're called a steamer, a kind of wooden deck chair that folds out so you can almost lie on it. And it's winter and she's outside with a big winter coat on. And she has a cut under her eye. And she's lying down reading, you know, at the newspaper. And it doesn't say anywhere why she had that cut under her eye. I know that she suffered with bad headaches because her husband says, I hope your bad headaches are better. So I don't know if she had terrible migraines. Maybe she fainted. Maybe she fell and cut herself. I also know that she couldn't have children. And I wonder whether when he was away, she went to a gynecologist. Maybe she was trying to do some sort of treatment. But this is entirely speculation. And it's only from the fact that he is concerned for her health and that I have found this one picture of her with a cut on her face and lying down in the winter outside. But how do you piece that together? So the way that I write it is list of questions. Could it be this? Could it be that?
Yeah.
Because that's the only way I can do it, you know, with integrity. So I'm not making it up.
Yeah. I feel like there must be an urge to kind of make things up sometimes. Like when you have like all these hints, but like not an answer.
No, it's really difficult not to. But, you know, you just have to not, because otherwise you can't believe any of it. I mean, I want it to be believable, and I want it to be, since it's the first time that this story has been told, I want to tell it properly. I really felt a responsibility to these women. I think every biographer does. Mm-hmm. You sort of feel they're standing behind you saying, no, cross that out. Funny.
I was wondering, just before we get more into the specific women, if you could talk about kind of what society's views on women were, like, especially like Kathleen Scott, like working, and like Orianna Wilson, like working as a scientist, attitudes about like women making money or like, you know, having like careers. Was that pretty like acceptable in their class at this time, or was that kind of looked down on? Because I feel like attitudes about that kind of like shift throughout history.
Yeah, no, I think it was definitely looked down on. Actually, there are two other women who tell you most about that. One is Emily Shackleton. So Scott and Shackleton went to the Antarctic alternately. The first time Shackleton went, he went with Scott. Then Shackleton went by himself, didn't manage to get the pole. So Scott went back. Then Shackleton went. It went like that. Emily Shackleton is not part of that photograph of the final five at the South Pole. She's not one of the women behind, but she was around. She knew all these women. Anyway, she went to America with her husband Ernest Shackleton a little bit later than this story, and she said she was amazed to see that in America women could work without losing caste with an E on the end. So literally, if you went out to work, your whole family went down a class. Because you were, and your husband lost his self-respect because the husband was supposed to support the wife. So the implication, if the woman went out to work, was that the husband wasn't able to support the wife. And that was a slur on their very moral character. I mean, really a basic slur. So incredible, isn't it? But you could get around it because women could be artists. It was acceptable to be artists because that wasn't sort of... you know, working as such. And so when Kathleen sculpted that the sculpture of Charles Rolls after he died, she was pleased to have the commission, partly because she wanted to lionize that man because she felt that he was a lion in that kind of era. That's how they talk about it. And partly she said it's also 30 beautiful pounds because they were really hard up. Although Scott said to her, you must dress well. It's really important that you keep up appearances. But, you know, Scott's, it wasn't paid for publicly. He'd had to raise sponsorship and he'd sort of mortgaged his house. And so she didn't have very much to live on. And so she was making money out of her art. And to start with, Scott had said, I don't want you to sully your art with, you know, money. It shouldn't be valued at any commercial worth. It should just be art. And eventually, you know, he had to agree that it was actually, you know, they were kind of surviving on her income a bit.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So that's quite interesting.
She's the breadwinner. Yeah.
So all the money he raised was just for his expedition, not for like their own income, basically?
Yes. She had to try and live on the least she possibly could. He wasn't a very good fundraiser, Scott. He was very kind of, I think, not a very rousing speaker. So when he went round Britain trying to raise money, he just sort of told it like it was. And he said, we're going there for the science. And then he realised that if he said the pole, then that made people think of a romantic thing. We're going to be first to the pole. We're going to stick this flag. So that's kind of, you know, how that evolved. But anyway, so he... Yes, so that the expedition was very, well, they wanted to be able to get two boats and they only got enough funding for one. So the Terra Nova, the ship that they took all their stores out to the Antarctic in 1910, was incredibly overloaded. They painted out the plimsoll line, you know, the line that shows how much it can be loaded, how low it should be in the water, because they had to get all their stores on one ship because they hadn't managed to get funding for the other ship. So... So all the wives had to live on very little. And when Scott realised that he wasn't going to be able to get to the pole and back and make it back to New Zealand through the Antarctic sea ice in a year, he knew he was going to have to take an extra year, he said to all the men, would you please forego your expedition salary for the next year in order for us to be able to afford to do this? So all the men who could do that signed off. So then that meant that their women weren't paid... an allowance for the next year. So particularly in the case of Lois Evans, it's quite an interesting comparison because she was living in Portsmouth in naval accommodation on Chapel Street in a pretty modest house. And at the time, the Titanic had just sunk with a big loss of life and quite a lot of the widows from the Titanic had been given... an allowance at a pension because they wouldn't be able to survive without the income from their men. So there she was in Portsmouth with these women being given a kind of, you know, compensation for their husbands having died. And she went to the post office past these queues of women standing outside the White Star offices of the Titanic, you know, for their allowance. And she went to the post office and said, please, can I have my British Antarctic Expedition allowance? You know, I'm... Taff Evans's wife, and the postmistress looked and said, oh no, there's nothing here. And she said, well, could you check please? And postmistress checked and there was nothing. But she realized that because they had to be completely confidential, they weren't allowed to discuss any expedition news, she couldn't tell anyone that she didn't have any money. So it got to the point where they were really poor and really struggling, and her cousin from Wales went down to visit and found her incredibly thin, you know, and with very little food, very cold in her house in Portsmouth. And he just said, right, come home with me.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
So sweet. He just said, right, that's it. You're coming home with me. So she went back to live in Wales because she just simply couldn't survive on no money in Portsmouth trying to keep up appearances. Yeah. Yes, money was a big issue for all of these women. And then when the men died, because this tragedy became world famous, there was an outpouring of cash because the last bit that Scott wrote in his diary was, for God's sake, look after our people. That was literally the last thing he wrote before he died. And so, titled that page, Message to the Public, because he hoped that his diary would be found. And so it's amazing, isn't it?
I'm gonna cry.
This was published, bearing in mind, this was published before Kathleen Scott knew. She was still in her boat. And this message from her dead husband had been published all around the world. So the outpouring of cash got up to 60,000, which is millions now. Mm-hmm. And so the interesting thing is that money was then apportioned differently to these five women. So they were given money, a kind of relative to their importance to the exhibition and their class. So Kathleen Scott and Peter Scott, this is an amazing, isn't it? So iniquitous, this thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Kathleen Scott got a big allowance and Peter got an independent, really quite substantial allowance for the rest of his life. And then when you look at Lois, who had three children, she was given a pretty modest allowance and she was given they said that they would made a generous offer of taking her first child off her and putting him in an orphanage.
Oh my God. Oh my
Isn't that amazing? Which she refused.
Horrible. Yeah,
isn't that incredible? Yes.
Yeah. So, like, I just lost my husband. I'm not going to lose my children, too.
Isn't that amazing? Quite amazing. Yeah. But this was considered to be a really generous move. You know, the Admiralty were kind of helping.
Gosh.
Anyway, so
they're, like, patting themselves on the back.
Yeah, it's incredible. But she was allowed an allowance for her children on condition that she arrived at the allowance office with them still alive, because they weren't sure whether they could trust working-class people not to claim for people who had died.
Oh my God.
Excuse me. Okay. I know. Isn't it incredible? It's incredible.
It's humiliating and cruel. Like, she doesn't deserve this.
It's just unbelievable. It's completely unbelievable. Anyway, so she had sold Taft's previous medal. So he had been to the pole with, not to the pole, he'd been to the Antarctic with Scott on the Discovery Expedition, which was 1901 to 1904, and he'd been given a medal. And when she was, you know, really struggling because there was no allowance coming in Portsmouth on the second expedition, she sold that medal. Entirely understandably, you can't eat a gold medal. and she had three children to, you know, put food on the table for. But then, after the men died, the king said that he wanted to meet them and he wanted to give all the people who had been a medal. Or, if they had been before, he would give them a bar, which is like a little metal strip, on their existing medal. So then Lois had to admit that she had sold the medal.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, really difficult. And the real difficulty, I mean, it's a very difficult story, really, you know, when I think about it, talking about it like this. But the first of the five men to die on their way back from the pole was Taff Evans. He probably died of a brain injury because he fell into a crevasse and hit his head. And as a result, he became very clumsy. He was an incredibly dexterous, bright, capable man, which is why Scott had taken him on two expeditions. But when he had this brain injury, he became clumsy and therefore he became a burden to them, a dangerous burden, because they were they had to sledge all the way back. There was nobody going to fly in with supplies. So they had to, and because they had to go slowly for him, they realised that, you know, they might not make it back. So anyway, so in his diary, Scott wrote, "The unfortunate man, Taff Evans, has lost his reason. He's becoming a real problem." And so when his diary was found and published, people said, well, why did he lose his reason? Did he go mad? You know, was it because he wasn't as educated as the officer class?
Oh my gosh.
And so, unfortunately, her children were bullied as a result of this, because...
oh my gosh.
Isn't it amazing? And so... So she, you know, she had to sort of stick up for them. She had a really hard life. Anyway, at the end of all this, I try not to have favourites, and I try not to qualify how I have felt about them. But the final line I have with Lois is that I hope that, you know, she is going to be recognised now for being an amazing, resilient, stalwart, resourceful woman. You know, and I hope that her ascent to full recognition is as steep and steady as her husband's, because her husband was recognised ultimately, and a building was named after him in Portsmouth. And the only people that had ever had buildings named after them in the naval dockyards were admirals before. So they realised that he really was a superhero. But Lois, because all these women have been so invisible, she's never been fully recognised. So now I hope she will be.
Yes. Come on, Lois.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And did any of the other women like try to have a relationship with her after, like the way some of them had been friends, or did they just kind of leave her?
Caroline Oates tried to, she commissioned her to make an altar cloth for the church at Gestingthorpe, which was the village that she was sort of Lady of the Manor for. Mm-hmm. So she was, I think, trying to give her money without just giving it to her as a sort of charity case. Yeah. And I think that's a really brilliant move. And I, you know, it gives me a lot of respect for Caroline Oates.
Yeah, Caroline was the one I would least have expected to be like reaching out.
Mm-hmm. Like, isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You know, she felt full responsibility for these working class people because she was looking after hundreds of them anyway. Mm-hmm. So I actually think she was probably a very good landowner and a very good patroness, as it were. Mm-hmm. And so she knew exactly what to do. So Lois, you know, was definitely helped by Caroline. Emily Bowers, I've already said to you, I can't find the letters. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can she not have helped Lois? She must have done, but I haven't got any evidence, so I can't say that she did. Oriana Wilson had a talk with Lois at one point when the Terra Nova ship came back, and I don't know what the talk was, but I hope that it was good. That all I know is that she had a long talk with Lois, so I hope that was supportive. Mm-hmm. That's the only evidence I've got for that relationship. Mm-hmm. Kathleen Scott wrote to Lois before they knew that their husbands had died and said, my husband has written in glowing terms about how fantastically useful and brilliant your husband has been. And I just wanted to tell you how in, you know, the high regard that he holds him in. Mm-hmm. So that was lovely. So those are the sort of support relationships that I can tell you about. But, you know, that's all I can see in the evidence. So there was probably much more, but I don't know.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for listening to part one of our Snow Widows episode with Catherine McInnes. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And before you come back to our next episode, you can feel free to check out Catherine on Instagram and her website.
You can find Catherine on Instagram at Catherine McInnes is her username. Nice and simple, just her name. And then also she has a website, snowwidows.co.uk, where you can go find out more information about Catherine, about the book, and place some orders if you would like. So yeah, so then come back for next time. We'll have part two where we're going to go a deeper dive into the stories of each individual woman because they are all super fascinating in their own right, kind of even outside of this already fascinating story.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, awesome.
Awesome! Okay, goodbye. Oh, wait, we didn't do anything.
I know. This is history. Okay, ready? I'll be chipper.
Ready. Okay. One, two, three, and...
This is history!
See, look, you did it chipperly, and we did it at the same time.
Okay. I'm gonna stop recording.